There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to NeuroNoodles, Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring tech legend Jake Gunkelman. He's the man who has read well over 500,000 brain scans, and Dr. Marie Swingle, author of iMinds. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you. Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration to polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as the featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Further inquiries about the program can be directed to Dr. Lori Russell Chapin at lar@bradley.edu. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices.
Jay Gunkelman, it's you and I, my friend.
The danger starts now. Huh?
That's right. So Marie is not going to be here, so
I'm going to talk like this and ask really smart questions.
And you can get one of those, the images that will put a wig on your head.
Yeah.
We can fake this one, you know.
That's right. Well, we can get away with a lot of stuff. We don't have anybody licensed on the show, so we can say what we want. So, Jay, what's on your mind, my friend?
Oh, you know, I'm thinking about the stress that kids are under nowadays and, you know, the ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences and how that ends up predicting later life health consequences, not good ones. And then I look at the news. I mean, the trauma. And we have all sorts of trauma, you know, therapists and developmental trauma therapists in the U.S. and stuff from just normal societal traumas. But war zones and the evening news is enough to put a scare into you, you know. I've lived long enough so I can have some perspective about this, but imagine being a teen growing up and having, you know, chaos online and on the news. And, you know, there's a tendency to follow the negative and, you know, blow up sensational stories and things like that. So it's a skewed view. But there's no perspective for somebody coming up. You know, the I'm 75 this year, for goodness sakes. If that doesn't give you a little bit of perspective, you know, you haven't been paying attention. And, you know, I've gone through, you know, Vietnam War protests and chaotic times previously. I'm on the front page of the local newspaper above the line on our lab in 1974, and below that is Nixon stuff as he's being toppled slowly. So, I've gone through governmental throes as well. So, some perspective allows you to not be quite as freaked out about it. But, you know, if you look at the incidence of anxiety and affective dysregulation that's being reported, and I don't know how effective, but there's all sorts of attempts to try to address that now as well. Online, and you know, that might be something that younger folks are adept at.
Is the ASA test? You brought it up. Some people may not know. Sure. And when did it come about?
Sure. Quite a few years ago now, there was a doctor who tracked young developmental history features and had a few thousand patients and saw the predictive value of these negative experiences. And it's basically there's 10 core questions that you can answer in a flash. They've done this in meetings where, you know, they present this concept to an entire group of social workers and psychologists and such. And the people actually take the exam. And if you have more than four answers yes to this, it ends up predicting hypertension, cardiac problems, stroke, bad medical negative outcomes that are usually considered somewhat stress related. And, they do show that an early intervention can counterbalance that somewhat. But the audience ends up answering these questions, and, you know, 40-50% of the audience ends up qualifying for long-term health consequence based on early experience. And, you know, you might say, well, sociologists and psychologists are kind of steered towards that field because of their early life trauma or something, but you can get similar results of any large group out there. And for some groups, you know, much more severe. So, now the doctor had a few thousand patients and he shared his results, and the epidemiologist basically said, nah, you know, you can't convince anybody with a few thousand. We have to have a few million. And they actually rolled this out with a multi-center study and gathered that data. So this is hard science. And the ACEs scores are predictive. And it's becoming more and more common for pediatricians, for instance, to end up trying to assess the level of exposure for their clients. And, you know, it's important. You can intervene early and have a fairly effective intervention and change the trajectory of somebody's, you know, life outcome. As an example, you know, you've got somebody who's got a high level of anxiety and they're panicky and they have phobia, over arousal negative problems. Well, a phobia, the first step in a phobia treatment is to drop the arousal level. if you don't drop the arousal level, you can't start to expose them to some hierarchy of things that are closer to the thing that they're afraid of, like a spider. You know, anything hanging from the rearview mirror is going to be seen as a spider. It could be dice, you know. But if they have the phobia, they have to drop their arousal level, and only then. So you can intervene with people that have high levels of arousal that have been triggered from earlier life circumstances. And there are techniques to train people to control their internal states. You know, historically, you'd have the traditional medical view. Your nervous system has two parts. The voluntary part, I can move my finger voluntarily, and then the involuntary part. Oh, your heartbeat, your blood pressure, pupil diameter, electrodermal activity, you know, all sorts of brainwave things, you know, these are all out of your control. They're in the autonomic self-naming or nervous system, the involuntary nervous system. But, you know, back in the 60s at Yale, we basically ended up having the wisdom imparted to try to look at the involuntary nervous system features and apply operant training to them. And at that point, their work was challenged. And, you know, there's a lot of traditional thought, and you're claiming voluntary control through operant training of the autonomic nervous system, which they could see could be classically conditioned, you know, Pavlov's drippy saliva dog, you know. Yeah, you can train a dog to salivate to a bell instead of to a steak, but that was classical conditioning and not volitional. And they pushed against that real hard. And when Neil Miller at Yale showed that you could control blood pressure, they absolutely went wild. And they claimed, oh, it's all mediated by muscle. And it flies in the face of everything everybody knew to be able to volitionally control something like blood pressure. Now, a student in his lab, Leo DeCara, actually took Karari, paralyzed himself, and then demonstrated voluntary control over his blood pressure. Now, try to get that through an IRB nowadays, you know, there would be no way that they would allow you to voluntarily paralyze yourself to prove that you're not muscle mediating the blood pressure control. Goodness, students are our future, but they're also our past. The students are those that built the field that we're in. And Neil Miller really realized that and set up a foundation to foster the students associated with AAPB, now FERB, F-E-R-B, Foundation for Education and Research in Biofeedback and Neurofeedback. So,
Jay, the question I have on that, ASA, I don't know when it happened. I don't need an exact date, but my point is what you just told me is they needed more data to put it through. Somebody must have been behind it, the government or something, to fund it to go to millions of people. Do you know how that went down? Because everybody says neurofeedback needs more data.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how that went down. I do know that the doctor who had collected the data, who, you know, this was a practitioner, not an academic researcher. And when he went to the researcher, he was told that the scale, you know, 1,000, he thought thousands, you know, well, look at most studies that are published, thousands of people usually are adequate, you know? So he thought he had some pretty good stuff, and he did, but not enough to convince the skeptics, which they needed to ramp it up. And, you know, I'm not sure how they ended up with the multi-center study, but that sort of thing is not, you know, a questionnaire handed out is not that hard to replicate out with a multi-center study and ramp up. Scaling that kind of a thing up is different than treatment, which ends up being much more difficult. But the ACEs basically ends up predicting negative outcomes. But some of those negative outcomes are now the teenagers that are panicky and are in need of assistance, and 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds and across all age groups, you've got negative impacts from isolation during COVID, the incidence of anxiety and isolation and dissociation, feeling separate from as a general sense, all that just ramped way up. And it's good to see, John Carlo Licata, his clinical practice, he posts anecdotes on occasion, sometimes with EEG samples that are unique and predictive and people talking about their experience with the therapy, and a teenage girl with anxiety and panic her life bloomed back to being a happy young girl with the intervention, basically with neurofeedback as well as cognitive behavioral and other interventions. They put together quite a nice package, and it's good to see that. My work with a handful of intractable epileptics. But there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of practitioners out there that are turning out routinely improved cognitive and improved emotional outcomes with neurofeedback. And it's a shame that kind of grassroots positive impact on people without such a wild, impossible to control thing like intractable epilepsy. You know, my focus on that was in part to show the power of the technique. I mean, if you can stop intractable epilepsy that they can't stop, and they're telling somebody they need brain surgery, control of an emotion is a piece of cake by comparison. So, it's really heartening to see the positive outcomes that are rolling out. And again, I'm starting to see them detailed online on some of the social media. And it's really nice to see.
Do you think schools could help things out by changing the hours of operation? Because it seems to me that the video editor of the show, I'm guessing that kids aren't getting enough sleep and the school is starting too early and it needs to change the hours. It seems the hours are there to accommodate the teachers.
There's also a question about homework and the actual value of or added value of routine homework. And I think schools need to totally restructure the school boards are all in local control, so you can think of something that would benefit schools in general, but it has to be implemented in a school in order to get it started. And
then you need more data for more schools.
You can end up benefiting kids with game-like interventions without any diagnostic tomfoolery. We do testing, a go no-go test to test for attention, and that's essentially a whack-a-mole. Something pops up, you got to hit it. Pops up over here, you don't. You can get a go no-go response. Behaviorally measured reaction time all of that kind of thing with a game. And without diagnosing, if the person gets a really bad score, they can go over and play that brain game over there and see if they can make the little fighter jets fly well, and then they can come back and play the whack-a-mole game again and see if they can improve. And all of these game things can be set up in very young, very, very young, pre-DSM diagnosis, and actually avoid the problem entirely. And it's all gamified, so you're not really diagnosing. The schools have difficulty. If you diagnose somebody, then they have to end up providing special services and that sort of thing. So they can be very resistant to the introduction of a program that ends up having a diagnostic features. I know that's changing. There are some that end up having to diagnose in order to get funds for specific projects. And one of the a young woman attending at the Sassoon Summit this year had such a program. So the diagnosis isn't a problem for everybody, but I've seen that raise its head as an opposition in schools. So,
with the internet and YouTube, knowledge education is no longer centralized, it's decentralized. If you want to learn something, you can go out there and learn it. The two values that I think schools have right now, it's daycare for parents and socialization. Okay.
Yeah. And I think the socialization is important, and can't be underestimated.
I guess what I'm saying, if the Jay Gunkelman NeuroNoodles School, if you had had an education component, a socialization component, right, you could split those things out. Because socialization, when a kid gets older, a teenager or past 18, I think they're better going, this is going to get some people upset, but volunteer, military, do something, Peace Corps, whatever it is, 2 years, serve, there's your, or get a job. You know, job is great socialization skills, right?
Yeah.
And if you want to get your...
And I don't think you can underestimate the value of international exposure. You don't really have an appreciation for the society you're in until you see other societies, and you get a sense of what's universal and what's unique and special and different, and there's some great food out there too. So international travel is really quite wonderful. I was lucky enough to do international travel to do lectures when I was still well enough to do that, and
I
adds a lot of it adds a lot of spice to life. I say that I'll say that.
I do see the value to that. I just think that that has value. There's certain things that, and I don't want to get too political on things, but anytime. It's like a government office. Anytime a school gets more money, they figure out how to way to add to administration. And the courses that are being offered, people are disappointed when they get done getting the degree in whatever it is. And the money they make doesn't support the lifestyle that they want. I think it needs to be rejiggered.
Again, the school district has to end up having proper programs. The little tiny town I lived in had a high school, and we ended up getting them grants to set up a career academy, which was not college oriented. It was oriented towards trades. They had traditional trades, electrical, you know, welding, construction kind of stuff, but they also had CAD CAM.
Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration to polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as a featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Further inquiries about the program can be directed to Dr. Lori Russell Chapin at lar@bradley.edu. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices.
Computer-assisted design and manufacturing. And, you know, if you go into CAD-CAM, you're going to end up having to do some math. So it isn't like this is like the people who don't have enough brains to do something. This is just people who are oriented towards a different end goal. And CAD-CAM is high level, but so is high level construction. And they turn out at the end of the high school people that are going directly into apprenticeships. They're being snatched up and placed directly into industry. And you know, directly into industry, you can end up having a job skill, and that after maybe 4, 5, 6 years of apprenticeship and you're a journeyman and some good experience, you can end up having your own firm, and you can be an employer of people that are doing electrical wiring and or plumbing or construction. And at that point, your income level is probably beating most of the people that got their psych degree and are now tending bar, you know. So
this is a mental health podcast. I don't want to stray too far, but when you don't have money and you have champagne tastes and you have a beer budget, that's stress. Especially if you're married, right? And that deals with mental health. And I think, I don't want to say it gets down to goal setting to figure out early on in life what's important, what you value. That needs to be carried out. And I guess that's the parent's job. But if you don't have both parents or any parents, and then you go through the school system that isn't set up as well as it could be, right?
Yeah, we were lucky that we had a school system that was able to be structured. And it was actually one of the most racially mixed schools in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I had relatives that were telling me that I had to pull my kid out into private school. And I said, well, why? And they said, well, look at the mix of people in the school. I said, that's a fabulous thing. Yeah, it's exposure. And
there's no racism in a foxhole, or it's 4th and 1.
And you basically end up with a full exposure to everybody. And it's not something that had a poor outcome. The school district actually has percentage of high end graduates. It's really quite good, and they had instructors that were PhD instructors. So it wasn't difficult to have a good education there, either college bound or again the career academy. And you know, the $400,000 CAD-CAM system grant was a big leg up for that aspect of it. but the trades came in and outfitted it for the wiring and all of the rest of the construction trades. So
Jay, where did this stigmatism come from? Trades? It's, oh, you're going into a trade, you're looked down upon. Is that the branding of colleges trying to, you know?
I don't have that.
No, I know that, but it's it has happened somewhere in the past where
I'm a tech. You know,
so, I'm a video editor.
Yeah. So people are people, and there are going to be people that end up looking down their nose at others, but that's their problem. That you don't have to take that on.
Well, no, we need more EEG techs out there and standardized learning. Because, you know, I heard on the show we had Tony Anthony Ramos on, and he's, you know, a Florida guy, and he works with a neurologist, and he was asking on our last show, I'll put the link right here where everybody can check it out, basically why more neurologists aren't pushing more EEGs, because the learnings aren't standardized. Not everybody's learning how to read an EEG the same way. Have you heard that too, Jay? Or
well, the inter-rater reliability for diagnosis in EEG medically is very low. It's not like the clearly normal, nothing wrong, or the clearly abnormal, but there's lots and lots of patterns in between. And depending upon your depth of education, you may or may not recognize the little oddities that are clearly not normal or abnormal, but somewhere in between. If you're a neurologist, you have on the average 6 months of specialization in EEG. Now, I can think back to 6 months of intense only EEG focus for 6 months, and I could spot 3 per second spike in wave. I could tell you a flat line looks flat, you know, and spot all sorts of classic patterns, but the subtleties aren't there until you've got thousands and thousands and thousands of exposures. Some guy wrote some book about 10,000. You have to do something 10,000 times for EEG. I think it's hundreds of thousands of times before you really, really get well tuned to spot something in the raw, just flipping quick through it. The electroencephalographer or epileptologist has a year and a half or more of specialized training. And they've got, you know, let's say you've got your neurology credential and you went on to specialize in EEG and you've got your EEG credential, you know, you're an electroencephalographer, you've got that paper up on the wall. But there's still another credential, pediatric EEG. Oh, well, you got another credential. And there's even another one, neonatal EEG, which is really specialized. And that's a rare one, but it's one that's critically important, because to not really understand what you're looking at can give you a big mistake. In premature infants, there's a pattern of a big burst and then flat, and then a burst and then flat. It's a normal pattern in premature infants. It's called trace alternant, an alternating trace. It's a French identified pattern. And it looks like burst suppression, which happens at death. So you don't want to be telling parents that, oh, I'm sorry, your baby's dying by misinterpreting the burst suppression. It's trace alternant. And you know that depth of experience comes not from 6 months of training. Nothing against neurologists with only 6 months of training. A lot of them are not interested in EEG. They may be the doctor in the hospital that has to read the EEGs, but they may be interested in peripheral neuropathies, you know, diabetic neuropathies, you know, people with numb, tingly feet, and, you know, that's their area that they really want to specialize in, something totally different. some, you know, spinal problems with people, stroke rehab. I mean, the neurologist could have a lot of other interests, not just EEG. The variability between interpreters at that point is quite large. They say 30% agreement. That's more disagreement than agreement.
It's not a good test score. Jay, we're talking about chemical energy, right? So you want to check the chemical energy of the heart. You do an EKG, and you get a physical, and you do that. Is that because it's simpler? I look at it like you have one outlet in the heart, but at the brain, you know, there's 19 different outlets and variations of waves.
Well, the heart's more complex than one. I mean, you have a 7-lead vector cardiogram to end up analyzing things really properly. But you can get a pretty good one off of a single lead, two electrodes, and a simple EKG. Like the little cardiomobile where you put your thumbs on both sides of the little credit card and you see your EKG.
Yeah,
or Apple Watches EKG and that sort of thing. But that's basically you end up having the watch on one arm, so the back of the watch is in contact with this arm, and then you touch the little cap button with the other, so now it's got a circuit between your arms, and it picks up the EKG and extracts it from all the noise that they pick up from that signal as well. So it, you know, it can be done.
But why is that recognized? Because you made the example. It's like, well, if you have heartburn, you know.
Yeah.
What's the example, Jay?
Well, you know, the essentially in medicine, the symptom tells you to do some testing, and then the testing tells you how to treat. So a cardiologist, if they operated like a psychologist, somebody would come in with their complaint. Doc, I have I've got this pain. I've got chest pain. And if they did angioplasty on all of them, half of them would have had indigestion, not a cardiac problem. So the symptom guides to testing. In psychology, the symptom, doc, I'm anxious. Doc, I'm obsessed. Doc, I'm depressed. Doc, I'm seeing things. Doc, I'm hearing things. Something wrong inside. Whatever the story is, it should lead to testing, not to treatment. The psychiatrist says, that's an interesting story. Try this. But there's no testing, you know. And if you look before you dive in, my grandmother was right, don't dive in unless you know what's under the surface. And it wasn't all about swimming. I mean, that was what she was talking about, but it's across life. It's best to actually look at the brain before you try to treat it. You know, in psychiatry right now, for instance, you can purchase a $250,000 TMS machine with a gigantic 1.5 to 3 Tesla magnet that they can point at a head and activate or inactivate an area on the brain. And you get your insurance company to pay for it because you're depressed and you've failed a couple of treatments. They don't look at your brain activity. Your complaint was depression and you failed a few treatments. So they pointed at the left frontal area, assuming it's left frontal. They don't look. And it beats placebo. But if you actually look what you're pointing it at, you avoid the flipping somebody into a manic state because they actually have beta on the right, not alpha on the left. And you know they're stimulating to try and activate with the assumption that it's a left frontal alpha. The iSpot D study that was over 3,000 patients internationally said it's not all left frontal alpha. This, you know, you can't think of depression as left frontal alpha. There's frontal balance. There's other things too, and it's not all left frontal. Some of it is frontal midline, as seen in the thalamocortical dysrhythmia literature. So reward deficiency issues at the frontal midline. So, you know, looking ends up telling you where to point that fancy magnet and whether to activate or inactivate. They treat OCD by activating the anterior cingulate with a double cone coil, two big circles bent in the middle, and it hits you in the anterior cingulate and activates it. If they looked, they would identify whether you had alpha or theta, in which case activating is fine. If you have beta, activating is going to blow this person up psychiatrically. I mean, this is not going to be a good outcome. You're pushing it exactly in the wrong direction. They don't look, they treat based on the OCD symptom. And again, symptoms should get you testing, which tells you how to treat, not assuming. The DSM does not predict appropriate therapeutic outcomes. If it did, the story would be enough. As it is, we know it doesn't work that way. So they walked away from the DSM because it just doesn't work. It's like a dictionary. You get the same DSM every time based on the behavior. You get the same diagnosis, but it doesn't predict outcomes for therapy. It doesn't tell you which drug is going to work. It doesn't tell you what treatment is going to work. You need to do testing. And testing for the brain, you know, EEG is one major way. MEG is obviously a big way. SPECT scan can test the brain. There are ways to actually look at it structurally and functionally. So
my simple take is the waves are moving all over. It's a constant thing in different areas. It's to get a snapshot of it. It's got to be a snapshot over time, right, to see the different changes.
Yeah.
And do you think it's just too hard to understand? Is it hubris that, well, we're just going to give a blunt instrument, a pill to just cover all the problems and knock somebody out? Why is the EKG so popular for a heart and the EEG is not so popular for the brain? That's what I don't get.
Well, the EKG can predict imminent death. So it catches people's attention a little bit more than the slow degradation that you can predict based on the EEG. EEG actually is very good at predicting outcome, mild cognitive impairment. Gee, doc, my memory is getting a little fritzy. Do I have dementia? Or is this just normal, I'm getting old? Why am I here, doc? You know, and the EEG can predict 2 years from now, in all likelihood, whether you're going to be still at home with a little help, or whether you need to be, hospitalized.
I'll give you an analogy. What about AFib? Okay. EKG picks up AFib. It's not going to kill you right away, but eventually you get a stroke, right?
And it may kill you right away too, with a stroke. I mean, if your heart's not pumping efficiently, the blood sits inside of it, and then it can clot. And once you've got clots forming in your heart, you blow them out. Now, at that point, they've got the aortic arch, could go out your arm. That's not a stroke. Could go up the left side. It might go outside your skull. It might go inside your skull. If it goes inside your skull, you've got a stroke. And that's got a single line going up to the left side. The right side coming off the aortic arch has a branch going out to the arm off of that ascending artery. So you have if it goes up the right side, you have a half a chance of it going out the arm and then some chance of being extracranial, intracranial. So you have a higher likelihood of strokes on the left hemisphere than the right hemisphere. That's stats, you know. You get it in the hemisphere that you get it in, and the likelihood is if you have AFib, it's an eventuality. You're going to end up having clots and throwing them. If they're big enough, it's a major stroke. If they're smaller, you may have experiences of TIAs because it's a very, very small vessel and it's not a not a major stroke. By that time, you're having a vascular dementia starting to build up.
I'm just trying to think of a simple way to explain this to somebody. It's if EKG, if you see the AFib, you say, you know what, one day you're going to have a stroke, you better take blood thinners right now. Okay, EEG, you have slow front, right? You have an issue there. You better do word games, whatever it is, neurofeedback, something to, you know.
When you see something not working right in the brain, there's two ways to control the neuron that you're trying to control. Ligand-gated ion channels, which work with meds, and voltage-gated ion channels that work well with neuromodulatory techniques. So you've got kind of one or the other, or sometimes both. Vince Monastra did a nice study in a school system. And they looked for kids that had high theta beta ratios at CZ, and that's at that point in the early 90s and late 1999, early 2000, that was considered a diagnostic of ADD, and all of those kids got methylphenidate, which is the med that matches up well with the high theta beta ratio. Half of the ones who got the methylphenidate also got neurofeedback. 6 months later, everybody got their meds pulled. The ones who had neurofeedback stayed okay. The others reverted to their ADD ways. So you can work with meds in the short run, but in the long run, neurofeedback gives you a skill set as opposed to an effect. And if you take the meds away, you've lost the ligand-gated ion channel control. You don't have the effect anymore. If you've learned to control the voltage-gated ion channel yourself, you've got a skill set. You have, as long as you want, you've got it. And in fact, they've shown that from intake to outtake in neurofeedback, that at the end level, how good you are at the control is measured. So you've gotten better control by the time you're discharged as no longer being a patient in the office. If they do 6 month or 1 year follow-up, you've actually gotten better at it. And you know the skill set consolidates. So all you have to do is use it. And
try it.
Well,
then go to the pills.
It's surprising how much control can be provided. Again, the demonstrations that we've done with intractable epileptics that were basically told they had to have brain surgery and you know, three meds, they couldn't control them, hundreds of seizures a day sometimes. So that, you know, you stop the seizures and the meds, and at that point you've got clinical success with training the voltage gated ion channels. So, it's entirely possible to control the brain. Who else is in control of your brain? Are there strings going up? Is there a master puppeteer pulling your strings for your brain? You know, you may have some triggers there built in from earlier experience that can, you know, others can poke that button and get a response. You're your master puppeteer of your own brain. And if you learn how to control it better, you get a better outcome. And the higher the level of control you want, the more likely it is that you're going to need to have tune-ups, fine-tuning. And neurofeedback is that fine-tuning tune-up. Go to Daytona 500 and see how often they tune those cars up, you know, so.
Well, Jay Gunkelman, the man who has read well over 500,000 brain scans from his Sioux Sun City office. I'm in the NeuroNoodle East office temporarily in Naples, Florida. Please enjoy the fine background. It reminds me of your neck of the woods with the boats going by in the little channel and all that. So that's it. good mental health staring at the palm trees, Jay.
Well, we've got palm trees here too, you know. So,
well, we got humidity.
There you go. Well, this year, Sassoon Summit's going to be October 9th for the arrival, 10th, 11th, and 12th for the meeting. And the 12th is the birthday party, my 75th this year. So we plan on a fun time. You know, it's kind of a three-day rolling party for me here locally. And we usually bring in some interesting speakers, so we'll get a save the date announcement out sometime over the next few weeks.
We gave everybody an 8. It's always in October. It's always Jay's birthday. Okay, book your rooms now. Let's go, baby. And then, hey, tell the yacht club, stock up on the Miller Lights, baby.
You know, the yacht club on all members on March 1st, the Commodore is giving the first drink is on him. So all the members are invited to stop over for a drink. Ding, ding, ding.
Jack, can't wait, my friend. Oh, have a great weekend, buddy. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Dr. Marie, see you next week.
The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you. Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration through polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as a featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Further inquiries about the program can be directed to Dr. Lori Russell Chapin at lar@bradley.edu. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices.